This interview with Professor Mike Bode of Liverpool John Moores University is part of the Jodcast. For the full show, go to www.jodcast.net.
Okay, with us is Professor Mike Bode from Liverpool John Moores University. You're presenting some research on the recurrent nova RSOF.
Yes, the work I was presenting was a continuation of a lot of work that's been going on the latest outburst of this recurrent nova.
Just remind us when that was.
It was February the 12th, the end of February the 12th, 2006, so it's just over a year ago. And it was the first time it had had an outburst for 21 years. The interesting thing about this object, and there's lots of interesting stuff, but is that it's a binary system where the explosion, which occurs on the component that's a white dwarf, that explosion throws material out at several thousand kilometers per second into the wind that's coming off its companion, which is a red giant. And when the two things impact, you get shock systems set up with temperatures perhaps an order of magnitude higher than the core temperature of the sun. Mm. The other interesting thing, among many interesting things, is that the white dwarf star is actually near to the maximum mass a white dwarf can have, which is the so-called Chandrasekhar mass limit. And we believe that mass may be being added net over a long period of time. So it's getting closer and closer to that limit, and eventually it would become a supernova.
This is mass from the companion star being added on.
Indeed, yeah. It's mass is being accreted from the companion star onto the white dwarf. Eventually conditions are such that you get this runaway thermonuclear explosion occurring,
right,
that leads to the nova being seen in the sky and the ejection of material and so on.
So what are the results this week that you're announcing?
Well, what we had done in a project led by Tim O'Brien from Jodrell Bank about a year ago, as soon as we'd heard of the outburst, we used radio interferometers, the very long baseline radio interferometers, such as the VLBA, which is centered in the US but stretches all the way from Hawaii to the US Virgin Islands, and the European VLBI network, to perform very high spatial resolution observations of the expanding remnant, if you like, of this explosion. And the first observations were taken only 2 weeks after the outburst and showed a ring-like structure, which was consistent with expansion velocities of something like 1,800 kilometers per second and consistent with the position of the shocks, the forward shock, as the ejector hitting the red giant wind. We expected from our X-ray data, which we'd already got in the bag from 3 days after the outburst.
What was that with?
That was with the SWIFT satellite,
right,
the data that we got, and we followed it, and we're still following it even now, actually, with SWIFT. It's still it's a faint X-ray source now, but at the time it became the brightest so-called supersoft X-ray source that anything had ever observed. We actually found that those supersoft X-rays were probably coming right from the central remnant rather than from this shock interaction region. And that's another story. It's something that gives a handle on the mass of the white dwarf and whether it will become a supernova or not. Anyway, we saw the structures then, and subsequent radio observations showed that outside that ring were two, to use an astronomically technical term, blobs of material that were expanding obviously at higher velocities and could be associated with some sort of jet-like flow, some sort of collimated flow from the central object. So lots of very interesting phenomena. We realized, and it was a real back-of-the-envelope calculation, that we may be able to detect, after a few months, the emission from this extended material using the Hubble Space Telescope. And we'd missed all the normal deadlines, so we applied for what's called director's discretionary time on the Hubble, and we got it. We got two orbits, and when we finally got to observe it, which was by this time July, so it's about 150 days after the outburst, even in the raw images you could see that this thing was not just a point source. And by various sort of image enhancement techniques, if you like, deconvolution techniques, we were able to determine that this emission was in the form of something that looked like two rings, but exactly the size that you'd expect from the continued expansion of the radio blobs that we'd seen earlier.
Right, so you knew how fast the radio blobs were moving.
Yeah, that's right. And we predicted how far out this material will be, and this is pretty much coincident with that sort of dimension. So what's giving this, well, the radio blobs, that sort of structure, and also this ring-like structure that we see in the optical? And together with Dan Harmon in JMU, this was modeled as, if you imagine a peanut-shaped nebula that you now incline. So you're looking partway along this inclined peanut. Right. And you then imagine that it's just the shell of the peanut that you're seeing rather than the filled thing. And you incline it. Then you'd see this structure that is very, very similar to our double ring structure. And it turns out that the inclination of this is consistent with the inclination of the central binary orbit. So it now links back and suggests that the highest velocity material is moving in directions that are at right angles to that plane of the binary orbit. And so what's causing that? So what's the so-called collimation mechanism of this? And a favored explanation is that it is actually material in the orbital plane prior to the outburst. The material in the orbital plane is rather denser than the material at the poles.
Right.
And so it tends to entrain the...
So all this stuff that's thrown off the star has to go one way.
Yeah.
The easiest way.
The easiest way, if you like.
The path of least resistance.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, and that's why we see this sort of shape. But we really need to explore that some more. That's a sort of first-order model. The important things that come out of this study are that we get the real... If this all ties together and it starts to explain lots of features of the outburst, including the way that the X-ray emission evolved, that we seem to need a pretty dense medium for the ejector to run into, and that would be along this equatorial plane for the X-rays to evolve as quickly as they do. There's evidence of dust in Orisov-Yuki, which seems to be there both before and after the outburst, but the shocks would destroy it. So... where is it? Well, if it's in this region that's very dense, the shocks haven't got to it yet, and it survives the outburst. So that would help to explain that.
Will it have to have survived many outbursts as well, because RSOF is a recurrent nova?
Yeah,
so.
It would have to survive. It depends what happens between the outbursts, because the wind will reestablish itself. But in the time scale the observations were taken on, then it seems that it does actually survive pretty much between the outbursts. It's in a region that's pretty protected. So although Nye Evans at Kiel is doing a lot more work on those Spitzer data, so that's a very preliminary interpretation, I guess.
So would there be any chance of any planets forming in this dense cloud of material?
That's an off-the-wall question. The one thing you could say, it's not a system where you'd expect to be looking for inhabited planets, certainly.
Nova going off every 20 years or so.
No, you've only got a couple of decades for evolution to occur, so it's not going to be somewhere that you'd want to live. Yeah, I mean, planets are seen in increasing numbers. I think there's something like 224 exoplanets now known. One or two have been found in pulsar systems, haven't they?
Yeah.
So, you know, they've survived actually supernova explosions. So, but the other thing is, knowing the inclination of everything, we now get the true velocities. And we find that the ejection velocities along the pole are something like 6,000 kilometers per second, which is starting to get up towards the velocities you see in supernova explosions.
Right.
I'm not saying this is, you know, the mechanism is very different in this case from a supernova explosion, but something is leading to very high velocities of ejection. And with a very high mass white dwarf in there, then you do need very high velocities to escape from the surface in the first place. So it begins to tie everything together in terms of our interpretation of the radio results, our knowledge of the central binary, and the circumstellar environment. So the HST, again, has played a major role in starting to unravel an astronomical mystery.
Are there many more observations possible or planned at the moment?
Yeah, we have got three more orbits of HST time. Those are to be scheduled, but hopefully will be done as soon as possible. The problem now, of course, is the whole outburst is subsiding, and although, as I said before, we still detect it as an X-ray source, it's a weak source. And undoubtedly, the nebulosity that we're looking for with HST, although it'd be bigger and in that sense easier to see against this very bright central star, on the other hand, it will have faded. So that will counteract. And so it's a balance between the two, and eventually it will fade away altogether. So hopefully we'll catch it before it's gone below the detectability level with the HST. Otherwise, we're going to have to wait another couple of decades.
Right, well, thank you for talking to us on the Jodcast.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you very much.